thoughtfully, then tapped another brief message. Nothing happened. She tapped out another message. Nothing happened. Is something wrong? Carol asked. This is the best I can get, Arch. Damn it. The message that shone in front of them read, Further data. See file.
See file?
He asked. These are the files. They apparently have more information in FBI files that aren't on the computer, Arch. They're down in Washington. Only in Washington. Why the hell is that? Chapter 67. At 10 o'clock on the evening of December 15th, Sergeant Harry Simkowski was thinking that he was actually solvent. He was financially comfortable, probably for the first time in his life. He just bought a new Ford Bronco, also a luxurious beaver coat for Mary. Life was suddenly getting decent for them, for the first time in their 4 married years together. But Stumpkowski couldn't bring himself to comfortably believe in any of it. This was all like Santa Claus and trips to Disney World, that kind of transient shit. Who could identify with a sudden net worth of $1,152,000? Harry Stumpkowski felt a little like one of those Looney Tunes who won the New York State Lottery, then nervously kept their little jobs as janitors or U.S. Postal employees. It was a matter of too much, too fast. At 10:20 that evening, Stumpkowski nosed his vest cab out of the street noise and blazing yellow lights of Midtown Manhattan in the East 60s. He finished his regular 10-hour shift, all according to the vet's master plan. Colonel Hudson's prescribed step-by-step plan for their ultimate success. The checker cab bumped and rattled onto the 59th Street entrance to the bridge. A few minutes later, the checker cab turned onto a busy avenue in Jackson Heights, then edged onto 85th Street, where Harry Simkowski lived with his wife, Mary. He absently licked his lips as he drove down 85th. He could just about taste the French stew Mary had said she was fixing when he'd left in the morning. The sudden expectation of beef, shallots, those little, light, puffed potatoes she usually made, was exhilarating. Maybe he and Mary should retire to the south of France after this was over, he began to think. They'd be filthy rich enough for sure. They could eat 4-star French food until they got absolutely sick of it. Maybe move on to Italy. Maybe Greece after that. Greece was supposed to be cheap. Hey, who cared if it was cheap or not? Harry Stumpkowski began to accelerate down the last flat stretch toward home. Jesus Christ, buddy! Stumpkowski suddenly shouted out loud and pounded his brakes. A tall, balding guy with an incredibly pained look had run out in front of the cab. The guy was frantically waving both arms over his head. He was screaming something Stumpkowski couldn't make out with the windows up. Harry Stumpkowski recognized the look from Vietnam, though, from dreaded cleanup patrols into villages after devastating phantom airstrikes. Something horrible and unexpected had happened here. Something awful had happened in Stumpkowski's neighborhood. The terrified man was up against the cab window, still screaming at the top of his voice, Help me, please! Help! Please help! Stumpkowski finally got the window rolled down. He had his radio mic in hand, ready to call for whatever kind of emergency help was needed.
What the hell happened? What happened, mister?
Suddenly, a small black Beretta was shoved hard, crunching like a nightstick, against Stumpkowski's temple. This is the matter. Don't move. Put back that mic. A second man appeared now, emerging out of the smoky 5th Street darkness. He yanked open the creaking passenger side door.
Just turn the cab right around, Stumpkowski. We're not going home quite yet.
An indefinite time later, hours? Maybe it was days. There was no way to accurately gauge because all time had collapsed under him. Stumpkowski felt hands angrily ripping under his armpits, lifting him rudely. The hands propped him hard onto a badly creaking wooden chair again. A man's face, a blur of soft pink, seemed to float down and stop close to Stumpkowski's face.
The man was uncomfortably close. Then his mind went into complete shock. Sergeant Harry Stemkowski's watery eyes began to blink rapidly. He tried to look away from this particular close-up face. Harry Stemkowski couldn't believe who this was. His eyes kept trying to lock into focus. His face. He'd seen it before, recently, always distilled by a network TV screen or a newspaper. No, he was confused. The injected drug had fucked his brain over. What was going on here? This person couldn't be. The face smiled horribly and said, "Yes, I'm Francois Montserrat. You know me under another name. This is an extraordinary shock, I know." Harry Stemkowski shut his eyes a moment. This was all a bad dream. Make it go away. Stemkowski opened his eyes. He shook his head. Suddenly, Harry Stemkowski's head ached unbelievably. His eyeballs felt indescribably heavy, as if they were hanging on elastic bands. He simply could not believe it. So incredibly near the top. The ultimate traitor. When Stemkowski finally spoke, he was close to being incoherent. Incomprehensible words squirmed through his gummy, swollen lips. His tongue seemed at least twice its normal size. Fuck yourself. Oh, please. Your time for being morally indignant is long past. All right, then. Look at what we have here. Look at this. Concentrate, Stemkowski fiercely reminded himself. Focus. Concentrate. Montserrat's hands were holding out a brown paper shopping bag up close to Stemkowski's face. Montserrat was taking something out. A blue cooking pot. Familiar? Once again, that horrible smile. Harry Stemkowski screamed. He fought insanely against his bonds, forcing them to rip into his skin. Up close to Stemkowski's eyes, a fork dipped slowly into the depth of the pot. The fork speared a dripping chunk of beef bourguignon that oozed brown gravy. Stemkowski screamed once again. He screamed and screamed. It seems you guessed my secret. You should also know by now how deadly serious this interrogation is. How important this is to me. Montserrat turned to his lieutenant. Bring in the unfortunate cook. Harry Stemkowski recognized his wife, Mary, but only slightly. She was a pitiful caricature of her former self. Her face was bruised, purplish and raw in extended areas. Her mouth opened crookedly as she saw Harry. Some of her front teeth were missing. Her gums were pulpy and bloody. Please, Stemkowski struggled. He lifted the chair legs right off the floor with his tremendous arm strength. She don't know. I know that. Mary doesn't know how you came to possess stolen stock market bonds in Beirut, then in Tel Aviv. You know, though. Lady, don't hurt her. I don't want to hurt her. So you tell me what you know, Sergeant. Everything that you know. You tell me right now. How did you get the stolen stock market bond? Once again, that horrible smile from Montserrat. It took another cruel and gruesome 15 minutes to get the information, to find out some, not all, of what Sergeant Harry Stemkowski knew. Information about the stolen bonds and Wall Street securities. About the bombings on December 4th. Not where Colonel Hudson was right now. Not even precisely who the vet leader was. But a start. A beginning, at least. And a beginning was better than what Montserrat had been accustomed to recently. Francois Montserrat stared down at crippled Harry Stemkowski and his wife. From Stemkowski's perspective, the terrorist leader seemed to be looking right through them, as though they were both insubstantial. You see now? None of your pain, none of poor Mary's suffering was necessary. It could have been 5 minutes of talking together at most. Now, how's this for just reward? A compact black Beretta appeared, paused so that the Stemkowskis could see what was coming, then fired twice. The very last thing U.S. Army Sergeant Harry Stemkowski ever thought, he and Mary never got to enjoy their money. Over $1 million, which they'd earned. It wasn't fair. Life wasn't ever fair, was it? That same question always left hanging, always unanswered in the end. Chapter 68. That night, Carol traveled home to the Bronx. As he slumped up from the garage, the ground around him seemed to be spinning. He climbed creaky front porch steps. Twinges of guilt struck hard. He'd been neglecting the kids for too long this time. The nightlight was on, but nothing much else downstairs. There was the electric buzz of kitchen appliances. Carol took off his shoes and tiptoed quietly upstairs. He stopped and peeked inside the front bedroom where Elizabeth, a.k.a. Lizzie, bunked with Nikki Kevin. Their tiny baby figures were delicately sprawled across twin beds. He remembered buying the beds years before, at Klein's on 14th Street. Just look at the little people. Not a problem, not a care in the world. Life as it ought to be. An ancient Buster Brown clock from Carol's own childhood glowed and clicked softly on the far wall. It was next to posters of Def Leppard and the Police. Strange world to grow up in for a little kid. Strange world for the big kids, too. "Hi, you guys," he whispered, too low to be heard. "Your dad's home from the salt mine." "Everybody's just fine, Archer," Mary Kay spoke. She'd snuck up from behind and scared the living shit out of him. "They understand the problems you're having, even watching the news." Mary Kay gave her brother a hug. She'd been 19 when their parents had died in Florida. Carol had looked after her after that. He and Nora had always been around to talk to her about her boyfriend, about Mary Catherine wanting to be a serious painter, even if she couldn't make any decent money at it. They'd been there when she needed them, and now it was the other way around. "Maybe they understand okay about my work. How about the other thing? Caitlin?" Carol's head turned slowly toward his sister. Mary Kay took his arm and draped it over her housecoat and shoulder. She was such a softy, such a sweet, gentle, and good lady. It was time she found someone as terrific as she was, Carol often thought. Probably she wasn't helping her cause, living with him and the kids either. "They trust your parental judgment, within reasonable bounds, of course." "That's news." "Oh, you're the word and the light to them, and you know it. If you say they'll like Caitlin, they instinctively believe it, because you said it, Arch." "Well, they didn't show it the other morning. I think they'll like her. She's a terrific person." "I'm sure she is. You have good instincts about people. You always knew which of my bows was worth a second look. You're a sucker for people who are full of life, full of love for other people. That's what Caitlin's like, isn't she?" Arch Carroll looked down at his sister and gently shook his head. Finally, he grinned. Mary Kay was so smart. She had an artist's sensibility, but she was so practical. A curious combination, and irresistible, in his opinion. Carol stretched his arm, the wound, that souvenir of a morning in France, still ached. "One day soon, I'm going to take a week off. I swear it. I've got to get back in touch with the kids." "What about your friend Caitlin? Did she take a week off, too?" Carol said nothing. He wasn't sure if that was such a good idea. He went off to bed, where he lay exhausted, but unable to fall over the edge into sleep. The number 13 wall computer screens were still running through his mind, perplexing images. If there was any one avenue he could follow on the trail of Green Band, it would lead inevitably to Washington and deeper into the restricted files of the FBI. Arch Carroll snored quietly, slept dreamlessly, and when his bedside alarm went off, It was just before dawn, and dark still.
Chapter 69. Washington, D.C., Carol had always thought, was the ultimate Hitchcock movie location. So elegant, so quietly lovely and distinguished, yet with paranoia. At 9 a.m., he squirmed from a blue metro cab with a dented fender. His face was slapped with raw cold and drizzle on Washington's 10th Street. Carol hiked his jacket collar up. He squinted through a thick, toothy morning haze, which obscured the concrete box that was the J. Edgar Hoover building. Once inside the Hoover Memorial, he found the procedure at the escort desk mechanical and unnecessarily slow. It irritated Carol in the worst bureaucratic way. The Bureau's famous procedures, the inefficiency they created, played like a skit appropriate for Saturday Night Live. After several minutes of phone checks, he was granted a coded blue tag with the FBI's official insignia. He slid the plastic card into a metal entry gate and passed inside the hallowed hall. An attractive woman agent, a researcher for FBI data analysis, was waiting outside the elevator on the 5th floor. She wore a man-tailored suit. Her chestnut hair was wound back in a tight, formal chignon.
Hello. I'm Arch Carroll.
I'm Samantha Hawes. People don't call me Sam. Nice to meet you. Why don't you come this way, please? She started to walk away, pleasant but efficient. I've already collected as much material as I can for you to look at. When you told me what you were fishing for, I put in some hours of overtime. My material comes from the Pentagon and from our own classified files. Everything I could collect this quickly on your list of names. It wasn't easy, I must say. Some of it I transcribed from material already on computer files. The rest, as you can smell, is contained in some really musty documents.
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 6. Black Friday by James Patterson. Continuing on page 308.
Samantha Hawes finally delivered Carol to a library-style Carol beside a silent row of gray metal copiers. The desk was completely covered with thick stacks of reports. Carol's heart nearly stalled as he gazed at the mountain of stacks. Each report looked like any other. How was he supposed to find something unusual in this great, yawning heap of history? He walked around the table, sizing up his task. Hidden among all these folders were connections between men, the tracks, the spoor they laid down, the events they lived through during and after Vietnam. Somewhere, surely, tracks would crisscross, correspondences would have been made, relationships established.
I have more. Do you want to see them now, or is this enough to hold you for a while? Samantha Hawes asked.
Oh, I think this will do me pretty well. I didn't know we collected this much dirt on everybody down here.
Agent Hawes grinned.
You should see your file.
Did you?
I'll be back over there, working in the stacks. You just holler if you need any more light reading, Mr. Carroll.
The FBI agent started to turn away. Then she suddenly turned back. Samantha Hawes seemed to be a very contemporary Southern woman, pretty, very confident, genteel and proper Southern from her looks anyway. In days of old, Carol couldn't help thinking she would already have been a young mother of two or three tucked away in Alexandria. She would have been a Sam, too.
There is something else.
Her face was suddenly quite serious and concerned. I don't know exactly what this all means. Maybe it's just me. But when I went through these files yesterday evening, I had the distinct feeling that some of them had been tampered with.
A very unpleasant warning rang in Carol's head.
Who would tamper with them?
Samantha Hawes shook her head.
Any number of people have access to them. I don't know the answer.
What do you mean when you say they've been tampered with, Samantha?
The agent looked straight at Carol.
I mean that I think documents are missing from certain files. Carol reached out and lightly grasped her wrist. He was excited by this information because it meant that certain files, in some ways, were already different from the rest. They stood out. Someone else had looked at them. Someone had possibly pilfered documents from them. Why? Which files? He saw a strange look crossing her face, as if she were asking herself about the precise nature of this unorthodox man who'd been admitted into FBI headquarters. Can you remember which files? Of course I can. She moved toward the work table and began sifting. She picked out five thick files, dropping them in front of Carol, saying, "This one, and this, this, this one, this one." He gazed quickly at the names on the files. Ferrero, Joseph. Dowd, Michael. Friedman, Harold Lee. Melendez, Pauly. Hudson, David. "Why these five?" he asked. "They served together in Vietnam, according to their documents. That's one good reason." Carol sat down. He still expected to come away from Washington empty-handed. He expected that the faint sense of anticipation he felt now would turn out to be nothing more than a false alarm. Five men on the FBI computer list of subversives, a term he knew was next to meaningless, at least the way the FBI used it. He checked his own printouts, and his heart suddenly clutched. Ferrero and Dowd had been explosives experts. And David Hudson had been a colonel who, according to the brief note on the printout, had been active in the Organization of Veterans Groups and Veterans' Rights after Vietnam. Five men who had served together in the war. Five men who were on both his list and the FBI. He slipped off his jacket, then the tie he'd worn especially for his big trip to Washington. He began to read about Colonel Hudson. Chapter 70. When he had finished reading, Carol tilted his creaking chair back. He shook his head. The ledger on U.S. Army Colonel David Hudson lay flopped open before him. Hudson's thick 211 file, his entire life in the U.S. military, was spread out on the desk. Suddenly, the Green Band investigation was more hopelessly complex and confusing than it had ever been. Colonel David Hudson was the final enigma. David Hudson's military career had begun with high promise at West Point, where he was an honor graduate in 1966. He'd been a four-year member, and finally captain, of the tennis team. He was also a popular cadet, according to all the available reports. It got even better, or worse, from there. Hudson had subsequently volunteered for Special Forces Q courses, followed by a Special Ranger training. On a first impression, at least, the Army couldn't have asked for a more diligent or professional young soldier. Colonel David Hudson, all-American boy. Every succeeding report Carol read was highlighted and underscored with phrases like, "One of our very best, the kind of young officer who should make us all proud, a model soldier in every way, unbridled, absolutely infectious enthusiasm. Definitely one of our future leaders. The kind of material we can build the modern army around." In Vietnam, Captain Hudson had been awarded the Medal of Honor and the Distinguished Service Cross during his first tour. He had been captured and transported into North Vietnam for interrogation. He'd spent 7 months as a POW. Hudson had almost died in the prison camp. He had then volunteered for a second tour, and performed with conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity on several occasions. Then, 3 months before the evacuation of Saigon, he'd been savagely wounded by a Viet Cong grenade blast and subsequently lost his left arm. Hudson reacted with characteristic bravura. A hospital report read, "David Hudson has been a godsend, helping other patients, never seeming to feel sorry for himself. In every way, a thoroughly idealistic young man." Following Vietnam, though, quite suddenly after his return to the United States, Colonel Hudson's career, his entire life, seemed to become disturbingly unhinged. According to the files, the change was bewildering to his friends and family. It was almost as if a different man had returned from the war. His father was interviewed and quoted several times. The fire, that wonderful, contagious enthusiasm, was burned out of David's eyes. His eyes were those of a very old man. Colonel David Hudson, enigma, almost phantom after coming home from the Vietnam War. First at Fort Sam Houston in Texas, then at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. At Fort Polk, Hudson was quietly disciplined for activities detrimental to the Army. Another report indicated that he was transferred twice within 3 months for what seemed on the surface to be petty insubordinations. His marriage to Betsy Henson, his hometown sweetheart, ended abruptly in 1973. Betsy Henson said, "I don't even know David anymore. I don't know this man who I'm supposed to be married to. David's become a stranger to everyone he knows." Hudson, in the post-war years, had become almost obsessive about his participation in a handful of Vietnam veterans' organizations. As an organizer and spokesman at rallies around the country, Hudson had met and been photographed with liberal motion picture stars, with sympathetic big business leaders, with recognizable national politicians. At one point during the morning, Carol meticulously laid out Xerox copies of every available photo of David Hudson. He rearranged the pictures until he liked the pattern of his collage. One photo was stained with coffee or cola. The stain looked recent. Samantha Hawes? Someone else? Or was he just getting squirrely? In the photographs, at least, Colonel Hudson looked like the classic, idealized military man of past decades. With his Jimmy Stewart wholesomeness, he looked the way American soldiers had been pictured in the years before Vietnam. He had short blonde hair in almost all the war photographs, a tightly set, somewhat heroic jaw, a pinched, slightly uncomfortable smile that was disarming anyway. Colonel Hudson was clearly very sure of himself and what he was doing. He was obviously proud, fiercely proud, to be an American soldier. Carol got up from the mess of official papers and wandered around the research library room. Okay. What did he have here? A leader, a natural soldier, who somewhere along the way had fucked up royally. Or maybe Hudson had been royally fucked. There were probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of men like David Hudson across the country. Some of them went berserk and had to be removed to the screaming floors in VA hospitals. Others sat quietly in dingy, lonely rooms and ticked slowly, like time bombs. Colonel David Hudson? Was he Green Band? Samantha Hawes reappeared with a pot of coffee, deli sandwiches, and assorted salads on a tray. Getting into it, I see. Yes, it's something all right. Odd and absolutely mesmerizing. Hard to figure, though. Carol rubbed the palms of his hands in circles over his red-rimmed eyes. Thanks for the food, especially the coffee. The whole file is extraordinary. Colonel Hudson especially. He's a very complex, very strange man. He was so perfect. The perfect soldier. Then what? What happened to him after he returned to the States? Samantha Hawes sat down at the FBI researcher's desk beside Carol. She took a healthy bite of an overstuffed sandwich. As I said, there are some really peculiar gaps in his military records. In all of their records, believe me, I look at enough of them to know. What sort of peculiar gaps? What should be in there that isn't? Well, there were no written reports on his special training at Fort Bragg, for example. There was nothing on his Q or his Ranger training. There was almost nothing on his time as a POW. Those should all be in there, marked highly confidential if need be, but definitely there in the file. What else is missing? Would there be photostatic copies or originals anywhere else? There should be more psychological profiles. More reports after he lost his arm in Vietnam. There's very little on that. He was tortured by the Viet Cong. He apparently still has flashbacks. All the backup data on his POW experience is conveniently missing. I've never seen a 211 file without a complete psych workup either. Carol selected a second, thick roast beef sandwich half. Maybe Hudson took them out himself. I don't know how he could get in here, but it makes as much sense as anything else I read yesterday. Like? Please keep going, Samantha. Like the way they made him a cipher right after Vietnam. He had very high-level intelligence clearance in Southeast Asia. He was a heavy commander in Vietnam. Why would they give him such a nothing post back in the States? The arm? Then why not write it up that way? Maybe that's why he quit the service, Carol suggested. The second-rate assignments once he got back home. Maybe. Probably, I guess. But why did they do it to him in the first place? They were grooming David Hudson before he came home. Believe me, they had serious plans for him. You can see tracks to glory all over those files. In the early years, anyway. Hudson was a real star. Carol jotted down a few notes to himself. What would a more predictable assignment have been, once he was back in the States, if he was still on the fast track? At the very least, he should have gotten the Pentagon. According to his records, he was on an extremely fast track, until the disciplinary problems, anyway. He got all these Bush League assignments before he did anything to deserve them. It doesn't make sense. Not yet, anyway. Maybe they'll know something at the Pentagon. That's my next stop. Samantha Hawes put out her hand to shake. My sincere condolences. The Pentagon makes this admittedly austere place seem like a hippie commune. I've heard they're a party group, Carol smiled back at Agent Hawes. Listen, she said, there is something else you should know. One other person went through the 211 files, at least one other person in the past 2 weeks. On December 5th, actually. Carol stopped packing up and stared at Samantha Hawes. Who? He asked. On the 5th of December, certain 211 files were ordered over to the White House. Vice President Elliott wanted to see them. He kept the files for over 6 hours. Chapter 71. The young Carroll boy had his marching orders, really strict orders, too. 6-year-old Mickey Kevin Carroll had been allowed to walk the 3 blocks home from CYO basketball practice since the 2nd month of the school year. He had very precise orders for the walk, which his Aunt Mary Kay actually made him write out inside his salt and pepper composition notepad. Mickey's orders were, look both ways at Churchill Avenue. Look both ways at Grand Street. Don't talk to strangers for any reason at all. Don't stop at the Fieldstone store before supper. If you do, it's instant death by torture. Mickey Kevin was pondering the confusing mechanics of the basketball layup as he covered the long double block between Riverdale Avenue and Churchill Street. Brother Alexander Joseph had made it look kind of easy, the layup. Except when Mickey tried it himself, there were just too many things to remember to do, all practically at the same time. Somehow your leg and your same arm had to come up, then you had to throw the ball perfectly into a high, high hoop. All at the same time. As he rehearsed the confusing sport's primary action, Mickey Kevin gradually became aware of footsteps growing loudly behind him. He finally turned and saw a man. The man was walking his way, walking pretty fast. Mickey Kevin's body tightened. TV movies and stuff like that made you scared when you were alone by yourself. Somebody was always out to get the little kid or the babysitter all alone at home. It was a pretty creepy world. Some of the people out there were unbelievably creepy. The man walking behind him looked pretty normal. Mickey guessed, but he decided to hurry it up a little, anyway. Without looking too obvious, he started to take longer steps, faster steps. He walked the way he always did when he was trying to keep up with his dad. There weren't any cars or anything at the corner of Grand Street. Mickey stopped according to his rules anyway. He looked both ways. He looked back then, and the man was really close. Really, really close. Mickey Kevin ran across Grand Street, and Aunt Mary Kay would have killed him on the spot. His heart was pounding a little now, really thumping out loud, right down into his shoes. He could feel his heartbeat. Then Mickey Kevin did the really, really dumb thing. He knew it the second he did it. The instant. He suddenly cut through the empty lot at the Riverdale Day School. There were all these tricky bushes and stuff back there. Everybody left empty beer cans and broken wine and liquor bottles. Mary Kay had forgotten to put that on the list. Don't cut through the Riverdale Day School lot. It was too obvious for words. Mickey pushed the prickly bushes out of his way, and he thought he heard the man coming through the lot behind him, crashing through the lot. He wasn't completely sure. He'd have to stop walking to listen close enough to tell. He decided to just keep running, to run like hell. Full speed ahead, running now. As fast as he could run with all the dark, thorny bushes, the hidden rocks and roots trying to trip him up. Mickey Kevin stumbled forward, his feet seeming to catch in dirt holes. He glided over slippery leaves. He nicked a rock and almost went over, head first. He was panting now. His breath was too loud in his own ears. His footsteps were echoing like gunshots. The back of his house suddenly appeared, the glowing amber porch lights, the familiar gray outline against the much darker blackness of the night. He had never been so glad to see home. Fingers touched the side of his cheek, and Mickey loudly yelled out, "Hey!" A stupid tree branch. He almost had a heart attack. Mickey then ran like a midget halfback bound for a 7 across the last icy patch of back lawn. Halfway there, his metal lunchbox popped open. It just about exploded as an orange rolled up papers, a thermos tumbled out. Mickey Kevin dropped the lunchbox. He crashed up the back steps and got his hand on the cold metal storm door. And then Mickey Kevin turned. He had to look back. His chest was pounding nonstop now. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, like a huge machine was inside there, making ice or something equally noisy to hear. He had to look back. Nobody was there. Nobody was following him at all. Oh, brother. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Nobody was behind him. Nobody. It was completely quiet in the backyard. Nothing moved. His lunchbox lay overturned in the middle of the snow. It glowed a little in the dark. Mickey squinted real hard. He was feeling pretty stupid now. He'd made it all up. He was almost sure of it. Except he still wasn't going to go back and pick up his fallen lunchbox. Maybe in the morning. Maybe in the spring sometime. What a little baby. Afraid of the dark. He finally disappeared inside the house. Mary Kay was dicing vegetables with a big knife on the butcher block in the kitchen. The TV was turned on to Mary Tyler Moore.
How was practice, Mickey Mouse? You look beat up.
Wash, huh? Dinner's almost ready.
I said, how was your basketball practice, fella?
I don't know how to do a stupid layup. It was okay. Then Mickey Kevin smoothly disappeared, slid like a shadow into the downstairs bathroom. He didn't wash his hands and face inside, though. He left the overhead light switched off. Mickey Kevin very slowly lifted a handful of lace bathroom curtain. He stared out into the dark, very creepola backyard, squinting his eyes tightly again. He still couldn't see anybody. The stupid cat, their stupid cat Mortimer, was playing with his lunchbox. There was nobody else. Nobody had really chased him. He was suddenly sure. He couldn't see anybody. He couldn't see the real-life boogeyman watching the Carroll house from the darkened back lot.
Chapter 72.
It was just after 5 o'clock when an Army colonel named Duriel Williamson emphatically strode into a windowless office hidden away inside the 34-acre Pentagon complex. Carol was already waiting in the Spartan bureaucratic green room. So was a Captain Pete Hawkins, who had formally escorted Carol from the visitor's pickup desk back through the dizzying grid of tightly interlocking Pentagon corridors. Colonel Williamson was outfitted in the full dress uniform of the U.S. Special Forces, including a blood-red beret, cocked jauntily. Colonel Williamson's hair was short and bristling, a salt-and-pepper crew which looked appropriately stern. His voice was starched as well, but showed heavy hints of irony. Everything about Duriel Williamson said, "No bullshit permitted here. State your business, mister." Captain Hawkins made the introductions in a polite, if strictly formal, military fashion. Hawkins was clearly a career bureaucrat, a survivor. "Mr. Carroll, from the Defense Intelligence Agency, on special assignment by order of the President, Colonel Duriel Williamson from Special Forces. Colonel Williamson is stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Colonel Williamson was David Hudson's immediate superior during both phases of his Special Forces training. Colonel, Mr. Carroll is here to ask you some questions." The Special Forces officer put out his hand to Arch Carroll. He smiled amicably, and most of the preliminary nervousness and formalities dissolved. "Glad to meet you, Mr. Carroll. May I sit down?" "Please, Colonel," Carroll said. Both men sat, followed by Captain Hawkins, who would remain in the room for the interview, a matter of protocol. "What is it you need to know about David?" Carroll's eyes widened and rose from a short, written list of questions he'd prepared for the interview. "The two of you were on a first-name basis?" he asked Colonel Williamson. "Yes, I knew David Hudson fairly well. I should amend that to be as accurate as possible. I spent some time with David Hudson, not at or because of the Special Forces School. This was after the war. I bumped into him a few times, at different veterans' affairs mostly. We were both active. We had a couple of beers together a couple of times." "Tell me about it, Colonel Williamson. What was Hudson like? What was he like to have a beer with?" Carroll controlled his eagerness to ask more probing questions. His mind was still clouded from the long morning at the FBI, but he knew better than to pressure a Special Forces colonel. "David Hudson was stiff at first, though he tried like the devil not to be. Then he was just fine. He knew a lot about a lot of things. He was a thoughtful man, extremely bright." Colonel Hudson's Army career seemed to disintegrate after Vietnam. "Do you have any guess why?" Duriel Williamson shrugged his shoulders. He appeared mildly puzzled over the question. "That's something that's always troubled me. All I can say is that David Hudson was a very outspoken man." "Meaning, Colonel?" Carroll continued to probe carefully. "Meaning he was capable of making important enemies inside the Army. He was also extremely disappointed. Bitter, I guess, is the better word." "Bitter," Carroll thought. "Exactly how bitter?" Carroll studied the Army colonel in silence. "The treatment our men got after Vietnam made David Hudson a very angry person. I think it disillusioned him more than most of us. He considered it a national disgrace. He blamed President Nixon at first. He wrote personal letters to the president, also to the chief of staff." "Just letters? Was that the extent of his protests for the veterans?" "I need somebody," Carroll thought, "with the kind of bitterness that would go well beyond letters. Hell, anybody could sit down and write a crank letter." "Actually, no. He was involved in several of the more vocal protests." "Colonel, any answers you can elaborate on would be helpful. I've got all night to listen." He called attention to Washington's long string of broken promises to our veterans, all the betrayals. "The disposable GI was a phrase he liked to use. "Let me tell you, Mr. Carroll, that kind of high-profile activity can earn you a fast assignment to Timbuktu or to some Kodok Reserve unit someplace. That would put him in the Pentagon computers, too. Hutton was very active with radical veterans. What about his training at the Special Forces School? At Fort Bragg? Carroll then asked. Colonel, these answers of yours, as I said, please try to be thorough. Some of this was quite a while ago. It didn't seem so important at the time. I'll try. For almost an hour, Colonel Williamson was painstakingly thorough. He elaborately described a brilliant young Army officer with seemingly boundless energy, with small-town American enthusiasm and talent, a model soldier. Many of the epithets Carroll had read earlier in the 211 files, he heard again from Colonel Williamson. What I remember most, though, Williamson said, what stands out to this day about Hutson is the time at Fort Bragg. We were instructed to push and drive him, push him to his physical and emotional limits. We redlined David Hutson at Bragg. More than other officers who were assigned to the Bragg program? Oh, absolutely. Without any doubt, we pushed him more. No punches were pulled. His POW experience was used to pump up his hatred for our enemies. Hutson was programmed to seek revenge, to hate. Who instructed you to do that, Colonel? Who told you to push Captain Hutson? Somebody obviously must have singled him out for special attention. Colonel Williamson paused in his answers. His dark eyes didn't leave Carroll's eyes, for there was a perceptible change in his broad, severe face. Carroll couldn't quite read the change at first. I suppose you're right. At this point, after all these years, I'm not sure I can tell you who, though. I remember we were unusually tough on him. Also that Hutson was pretty much up to it. He definitely had character to spare. But his training wasn't typical, not the regular course. His was different somehow? Yes. David Hutson's training at Fort Bragg was beyond the established norm, which was demanding in itself. Give me some idea, Colonel. Put me at the training camp. Can you make it come alive for me? What was the actual training like? All right. I don't think you can imagine it unless you actually went through it. Up at 2:30 in the morning, physical abuse, drug-induced nightmares, interrogation by the best in the Army, pushed like a dirt farm tractor until you dropped at 8, up again at 2:30. I mean pushed, drained. Each day was 100% harder than the last, physically and emotionally, psychologically. The men chosen to go to Bragg were all considered top rank. Hutson had West Point and extensive combat behind him. He'd been a successful commander in Nam. Captain Hutson was also a military assassin in Vietnam. He was very heavy, with a good rep. Carroll, hearing the word assassin, felt that he had taken still another step into the endless green band maze. The further he moved, the more confused and lost he became. The all-American soldier had an even darker side. Assassin. He brought Hudson's clean-cut photographs back to mind. The sunshine face of determination, the bristling crew-cut hair, the honesty in those eyes. Meaning what, Colonel? What does a good rep mean in that context? As a military assassin. It means he wasn't a thrill killer, which some of the top hitters were. A real problem is what to do with some of those guys once they leave the Army. If the generals had decided to take out Ho Chi Minh, something very big, very delicate, Hutson most likely would have been considered. You seem a little awed by Hutson yourself. Williamson smiled. He chuckled softly into his chest full of nettles. I don't know about awe. Awe isn't the right word. Definitely respect, though. Why, Colonel? He was one of the best soldiers I've ever trained. He had physical endurance and all the technical skills. He had strength and tremendous smarts. He also had something else, dignity. So what went wrong? What happened to Hutson after the war? Why did he finally leave the service in 1976?
Colonel Williamson rubbed his clean-shaven jaw. As I said, the one problem was his attitude. He could be extremely judgmental. He also thought he had answers to some controversial Army problems. Some career officers might not have appreciated Hudson's judgment of them and their actions. The other thing was the loss of his arm. David Hudson had big, big plans for himself. How many one-armed generals are you aware of? Carroll paused and thought before he spoke again. For all the apparent cooperation, he had a sneaking feeling that Colonel Williamson was still holding something back. It was the Army way. He remembered from extensive past dealings with the Pentagon. Everything had to be a huge need-to-know secret, shared only inside the sacred fraternity of Army blood brothers, shared with the other warriors only. Colonel Williamson, I've got to ask the next few questions with the authority of the Commander-in-Chief. That means I need complete answers. That's what you've been getting. Colonel Williamson, did you know the official purpose of David Hudson's Special Forces training at Fort Bragg? Why was he at the JFK school? If that information was in any of your orders, if you heard it anywhere on the base, I need to know it, Colonel. Colonel Duriel Williamson stared back hard at Carroll, then at Captain Hawkins. When he spoke, his voice was softer but seemed an octave deeper than it had been. Nothing was ever written down in any of the orders. As I said, I don't remember who actually issued our daily orders. I do know why he was supposed to be there, though. Go on. Please, Colonel. It was something we were told at the very first briefing on David Hudson. Verbally told. This first briefing sounded like CIA bullshit, by the way. Until we actually met Hudson, you see. They told us Hudson had been specially chosen to be our version of the Third World super-terrorist. David Hudson had been selected, and he was being trained to be our version of the terrorist, Juan Carlos. Carroll's stomach had suddenly dropped. His forehead felt flushed. He leaned forward in his chair. That's why he was at the Bragg School? Why he was pushed ahead beyond all the others? That's what we helped teach him to be. And Mr. Carroll, Captain Hudson was good at it. He is still good, I'm sure. From planning a terrorist raid, even a murder if it was necessary, David Hudson was on a level with Carlos. The Army trained Hudson to be the best, and in my opinion, he was. Maybe that's why they couldn't keep him content in the peacetime Army. Carroll didn't speak, because at that moment he couldn't. The realization that the Army had secretly trained its own Carlos, and that he had possibly turned, it was unbelievable. Colonel, in your opinion, could Hudson have been involved with Green Band? Could he have technically masterminded an operation like that? I don't doubt it, Mr. Carroll. He has all the technical skills. Williamson paused, sighed. One more fact about Hudson, though. When I knew him, at least, and I think I knew the man fairly well, he loved the United States very much. He loved America. Make no mistake, David Hudson was a patriot. Chapter 73. That evening, very late in Washington, President Kearney was feeling completely debilitated and old, decades older than his 42 years. The sheen of sweat covering his neck was cold and made him feel ill. It was past 1:30, and the White House was quiet. As he walked the corridors of power, the President of the United States held a confidential document under his arm. The sheaf of papers was pressed tightly against his right side by his elbow, but seemed to burn through the material of his suit and shirt to scald his skin. Nearly every president, as well as a few chosen first-time senators and key congressmen, had learned an important U.S. history lesson when they arrived in the capital city of Washington. Kearney had learned his within the first month of his presidency. The lesson was that within the broadest scope of American power and its immense wealth, the politician was little more than an appendage to the system, a concession to form, a necessary inconvenience in many ways. The politician, senator, congressperson, judge, even the president was grudgingly tolerated, but each was expendable. The presidents before Justin Kearney, Reagan, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Kennedy, Johnson, had all learned the lesson in one way or another. Even the seemingly powerful and secure Secretary of State Kissinger had eventually learned his lesson. There was a higher order working inside, working above and beyond the United States government. There had been a higher order for decades. It made all the sense in the world, actually. It made sense of almost everything that had happened over the past 40 years. The Kennedys, Vietnam, Watergate, Koreagate, the Star Wars plan. They were waiting for President Kearney in the dramatic and imposing National Security Council briefing room. 12 of them had been inside there for some time, working through the night. They appeared to be an ordinary enough committee, all in white shirt sleeves and loosened ties. They stood in mass as the President of the United States entered. They rose out of respect for the office, for the lofty traditions, for what they themselves had rigorously maintained about the office. The 41st President of the United States then took his accustomed seat at the head of the highly polished oak wood table. Pens and lined yellow writing pads had been set neatly at his place. "Did you read the position papers through, Mr. President?" one of the 12 committee men quietly asked Kearney. "Yes, I read it in my office just now," the president solemnly answered. His strongly handsome face was pale, drained of its natural color. The president then laid the substantial packet of confidential papers he'd been carrying on the table. The booklet was approximately 160 typewritten pages. It had never been copied, and never would be. It looked somewhat like an investment offering book or perhaps a condominium plan. On the dark blue cover, something had been printed in regal-looking gold letters. "Greenband. Extremely confidential and classified." The title page was dated May 16th, 7 months before the actual bombing attack on Wall Street. Part 3. Arch Carroll. Chapter 74. Friday in Washington dawned with rain clouds rolling across a nearly colorless horizon. A spitting wind blew wintry gusts in from Maryland. The temperature was dropping hourly. From 7 a.m. on, Carroll waited impatiently in the front seat of a rented sedan parked in the Washington suburb of McLean. The dark car blended with a wall of even darker fir trees overhanging Fort Myers Road. "Detective work," Carroll thought as he stared off into nothingness. "First you wait. Always the waiting." Carroll passed the early time eating breakfast out of a warm cardboard box from Dunkin' Donuts. The donuts weren't as hot as the box itself. They also had no taste. The coffee he sipped was room temperature, a little less satisfying than the donuts. Carroll read some Tracy Kidder, The Soul of a New Machine, and that was good, at least. Several times he found himself thinking about Colonel Hudson. The All-American boy? West Point honor student? Then Vietnam assassin? America's jackal? America's Francois Montserrat? He wanted to meet Hudson. He wanted to encounter him one-on-one, face-to-face, maybe inside the interrogation room at number 13 Wall, Carroll's own turf. "Tell me, Colonel Hudson, what do you know about the Green Band firebombing? What about the stolen Wall Street securities? Tell me why you left the Army, Colonel." He wondered how far he'd get with somebody like Colonel Hudson, a U.S. saboteur trained to resist interrogation. About 7:30, a second-floor light finally blinked on inside the white colonial across the roadway. A second light followed moments later.
Bedroom and bathroom, probably. Moments later, a light went on downstairs. Kitchen? The porch light blinked out. Just past 8, which Carol thought a respectable hour, he trudged up the flagstone front walk and rang a bell which made a chimey sound like old department store bell. A tall man of about 60 appeared in the pristine white doorway. He wore plaid trousers, house slippers, a powder blue cardigan sweater. His head, shaped like a torpedo, was topped with white-gray stubble. General Lucas Thompson, former Commander-in-Chief of the United States Evacuation Forces in Vietnam, still had a craggy, commanding presence. He still appeared capable of taking on combat duty demands. There was something hard and alert in his eyes, like small electric light bulbs burning there. General Thompson, I'm Arch Carroll with the DIA. Sorry to bother you so early in the morning. I'm here about the Green Band investigation. General Thompson looked appropriately suspicious. His eyes became slats of loose flesh. What about it, sir? I'm up, but as you say, it's still quite early in the morning. I would have called last night to say I was coming, General. It was late when I left the Pentagon. I thought that might have been a worse breach of etiquette than just coming out here this morning. The look of consternation and puzzlement faded on General Thompson's face. It was as if the mention of the word Pentagon had reassured him. A look of pleasant recognition spread across his features. Of course, Arch Carroll, I've read about you. General Thompson, I have just a few questions. It's about your command in Southeast Asia. It shouldn't take more than, say, 20 minutes. That means an hour, Lucas Thompson said with a sniffling laugh. He swung open the front door anyway. That's fine. I have the time. Time is plentiful these days, Mr. Carroll. He spoke in the tone of a retired soldier stricken by writer's block halfway through his memoirs. Vaguely frustrated, a little bored, abandoned not only by his muse but by his sense of purpose. General Thompson led the way inside, through a formal 1930s dining room, into an even more imposing library chamber. There was a white birch fireplace screened by a brass curtain with heavy brass andirons. Tall oak bookshelves stood erect on every wall. A double bay window looked onto a backyard with a covered pool and yellow and lime-striped cabana. General Thompson sat in a comfortable wing chair. Out of sight in Washington, pretty much out of mind. Since my retirement, I've had very few official visitors down here, other than my 2 granddaughters, who fortunately live up the lane, and who adore their grandmother's baked goods and double fudge. General Thompson shook his head and smiled. He was easing into the interview more than Carol had expected or hoped. In Vietnam, Carol had heard that Thompson was an extremely rigid disciplinarian. Now, in his retirement, Lucas Thompson seemed like just another grandfather, patiently waiting for the next Kodak snapshot to be taken. I'm searching, groping, is the word I think I want, for some useful information about a Colonel David Hudson. Hudson was on your command team in Saigon, right? General Thompson nodded in the manner of a practiced good listener. Yes, Captain Hudson served on my team for about 15 months. If my recollection is holding up better than the rest of me. Your recollection and my records match exactly, Carol said. What can you tell me about Hudson? Well, I'm not sure where you want me to start. It's fairly complex. David Hudson was an extremely disciplined and effective soldier, also a very charismatic leader, once he got his command over there. When I first met him, he was ramrodding a demolition team. He'd also been trained to sanction human targets. He sanctioned trash, Carol. War profiteers. A couple of high-level infiltrators. Traitors. Why was he chosen to be a military assassin? Oh, I think I have the answer for that one. He was chosen because he didn't like to kill. Because he wasn't a psycho.
I think Hudson's philosophy was that once you undertook to fight in a just war, you fought. You balls out fought with everything you had. I happen to believe that philosophy myself. During the next 30 minutes, General Lucas Thompson elaborated on his association with David Hudson. It was an overall laudatory review, an A-plus for Hudson, high marks for conduct, combat team leadership, especially high marks for courage and charisma. That latter, a nebulous quality the modern army seemed to take into account the way a Civil War battalion, say, would have given a man a commendation for his musket aim. Arch Carroll kept getting the very uncomfortable feeling that he was chasing after a goddamned American war hero. Once again, it didn't make complete sense. Carroll leaned way forward in the red leather easy chair he'd taken in the retired officer's library. General Thompson was beginning to repeat himself slightly. He seemed to be slipping into a genial storytelling mode. It might have been sad, ordinarily. In a way, it reminded Carroll of his own father, retiring from the New York police force to Sarasota, dead of heart failure, or maybe it was boredom, within 9 months. Except that Carroll didn't believe General Lucas Thompson's act for a minute right now. Carroll had checked carefully, and General Thompson had been receiving official visitors out in McLean, high-ranking VIPs from the Pentagon, even regular visitors from the White House. General Lucas Thompson was still an influential advisor to the National Security Council. There are a couple of things that still bother me, General.
Shoot away, then.
Just for openers, why can't anyone tell me where Colonel Hudson is now?
Second point,
why can't anyone explain the mysterious circumstances under which he left the Army in the mid-70s? Third point, General Thompson, why did somebody rifle through his war records at the Pentagon and the FBI before I could see them?
Mr. Carroll, judging from the tone of your voice, I think maybe you're getting a little out of order,
General Thompson said in a voice that remained low, perfectly in control.
Yeah, well, I do that sometimes. Fourth point, the last thing that bothers me, really frosts me. Why was I followed from the Pentagon last night, General? Why was I followed out here to McLean, General? On whose orders? What the hell is going on here in Washington?
General Lucas Thompson's shiny, clean-shaven cheeks, his crinkle-cut neck blossomed bright red.
Mr. Carroll, I think you'd better leave. I believe that would be the best for all concerned.
You know, I think you're probably right. I think I'd be wasting my time here, General. I think you know a whole lot more about Colonel Hudson, though. That's what I think.
General Thompson smiled, just a faint, condescending twist of his upper lip.
That's the unappreciated beauty of our country, Mr. Carroll. It's free. You can think whatever you like. I'll show you to the door.
Chapter 75. On the morning of December 17th in New York, David Hudson was feeling more self-conscious about his affliction than he had in years. Clutching Billy Bogan with his good arm, he steered her in a protected manner through an onrushing tide of people on Fifth Avenue. He didn't want to think about the resumption of Green Band, not for a few more hours anyway. David Hudson's self-consciousness was particularly unnecessary that morning. The two of them, paired together, were striking. They looked as if they'd been painted with thick, bold strokes, while everyone else had been lightly drawn by pencil or pen. Billy Bogan watched David from the corner of her eye, so very serious, charting their appointed path through the crowd. She felt an odd but growing fascination. That he was obviously taken with her made the attraction she felt much more irresistible. She allowed herself to be pulled forward toward whatever was looming up ahead. Where were they headed, anyway?
Are you a Christmas lover? Billy asked, as they moved ahead through the cold, flat knife of the winter day around them.
Oh, it depends on the Christmas. This Christmas I have a strange passion for the season. I want to drink in the sights, the evergreen trees and the holiday wreaths, the glimmering store windows, Santa Clauses, churches, choral music.
You do seem to go all the way on things, she lightly teased Hudson.
Or not at all. Just look at this insanity, this wonderful monstrosity. He suddenly whooped and grinned broadly. It was quite unlike his usual self, at least the part she'd seen. They'd finally come up close to the glittering, extravagantly over-decorated Rockefeller Center tree. A crowd, lovers mostly, from college-aged to quite elderly, was clustered over the top of the skating rink and attached restaurant. A small boys' choir, innocent in cassock and surplice, sang the loveliest carols down below. Colonel Hudson's brain had finally slowed. He was relaxed and relatively comfortable right now. An exceedingly rare treat, to be savored. He occasionally felt a stab of guilt about his mission, about losing concentration, but he knew the release of tension could be valuable, too.
Do you miss your family, your home? Being away from England during the holidays, he asked.
He and Billy caught one another's eyes and held on for a long few seconds. As it had been with the two of them from the start, they seemed almost alone now, in spite of the shoving masses crowding the square.
I miss certain incidents from the past, some charming things about my sister, my mother. I don't miss home too much, no. Life in the Midlands. Birmingham is one of those places from which all the young people, all the reasonably bright ones, want to get away. If you remain in Birmingham, you work for British Steel, or perhaps the new exhibition center. Once you marry, you stay home with your brood. Watch the new morning BBC. You get fat. You're thinking petrified. After a few years, no one can imagine that any of the women were ever pretty slips of young girls. Almost no one over 40 looks like they were ever young.
So you escaped? London? Paris?
I went to London when I turned 18. I was crude, unpolished, in the way that I looked, the way I thought about the world. I wanted to be an actress, a fashion model, anything that would keep me from ever going back to Birmingham. Ever. Billy smiled, and she was so charmingly self-effacing.
I made a few minor misjudgments in London, she said with a mocking laugh.
And then? After, I guess it was 5 years there, I decided to either come to New York or Paris. That's me up to the present. I'm hopeful I can do well as a model. I'm putting together a book for press advertising. That's magazines and newspapers. I know that I'm attractive, physically attractive.